From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The chair recognizes Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Have we located Mr. Duncan? Is he potentially in the Dominican Republic or maybe Wisconsin or something? Did we send somebody out yet?
We'll get back to you on that, sir.
Let me be clear. This is not a pro-union bill. This is not an anti-governor bill.
This is a direct shot at this governor, make it very clear. But this is a clear assault upon the executive authority of this state of Illinois.
This will be a significant step by the governor in what I would fear will be an effort to bring down wages and standard of living for middle-class families.
We're about the most useless politicians in the state of Illinois right now because we can't come to an agreement on anything.
And those are some of the comments from the Illinois House floor this past week. As we approach Labor Day, it was a labor issue dominating discussion during the House's weekly visit to the Capitol. And due to the absence of a Democratic lawmaker, in part at least, labor lost this particular battle. Oh yeah, still no budget either. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel this week on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Brian Mackey, State House Reporter for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, and joining us from Chicago, Greg Hines, political writer for Crane Chicago Business. Greg, thanks for joining us this week.
My pleasure, guys.
And we'll start with Greg and Brian. A little background, a little explanation of the labor battle we had at the state capitol this week, and then we'll talk about somebody was missing in action fun after that.
Yeah, this is basically the unions have pushed a piece of legislation. They're in contract negotiations with Governor Bruce Rauner's administration this year. This is particularly the AFSCME union, which represents tens of thousands of state prison workers and other state employees. They had pushed a piece of legislation that says basically if they can't come to an agreement with the administration, it would go to arbitration. Arbitrators would get to decide. It would also prevent the administration from locking out workers, and it would prohibit the union from striking if there was this sort of impasse. The governor called it one of the worst pieces of legislation he's ever seen. He vetoed it. He worked very hard to defeat it. The unions were very they said at least that they were confident. The House Speaker Michael Madigan said he was confident going into this vote to override the governor's veto, and they came up short.
And they came up short. Was in the short scheme of things, Greg Hines, this seemed to be a little bit of a loss for Democrats and the unions in trying to arm wrestle with the governor.
Yeah, it does. This particular clash was arguably the biggest single fight other than the budget itself that the mayor and the speaker have had since the new sheriff rode into town. At stake, literally, was Rauner's influence over a big part of state government. I mean, one of the main things the governor does is handle collective bargaining with unions, and this would have moved him out of the way and sent a big message that on things of importance, the Democrats could hold their stuff together and push him out of the way and make him irrelevant. No governor ever wants to be in that position. This was a win for Rauner. The speaker had repeatedly said that he had the votes. No, he didn't have the votes. This doesn't end the war, but I think it puts us back in a stalemate position. We were getting close to a position where perhaps the Democrats could have gone on their own without the governor. Well, now we're back to Madigan doesn't have the votes to do what he wants to do, but Rauner doesn't have the votes to do what he wants.
So everybody has enough votes to keep it at gridlock.
You got it.
And as we look at this legislation, it was kind of, I mean, people thought the Democrats had the votes to override. They seemed to bring people out of their sick beds to Springfield. But then we had the failure of Ken Duncan, a Democrat from Chicago, who was a no-show. He was reportedly in New York. But there was always this, we'll raise the conspiracy theories, the question of whether was this a no-show because he was out having fun and didn't care, or was this a no-show because somehow Bruce Rauner got to him in some way?
Yeah, there was a little... Sorry.
If you get the answer to that, let me know. And any of you guys, this is good. I think it's become a little bit of a legendary state lore here. All that we know for a fact is that on Monday, a couple days before the vote, Representative Duncan posted a picture of himself with a group of people in Grand Central Station in New York City. Friends of his say he was on a family trip, and there's nothing to it. But people in the black community have suggested that he was unhappy with portions of the bill, and there have just been a ton of rumors around, all denied by the Rauner administration, but circulating nonetheless, that somehow the governor, who appeared at a Duncan fundraiser this summer, has reached some kind of accommodation with him.
Yeah, and we had some tongue-in-cheek suggestions that the Governor Rauner would soon be introducing State Fire Marshal Ken Duncan, you know, or something like that. But seriously, this is not the first time Representative Duncan has missed a very consequential vote in Springfield. He was on a Caribbean cruise when the House took its vote to impeach Governor Rod Blagojevich a few years back. This is also a representative who's, you know, gotten the so-called Century Club trophy a couple of times, where you get more than 100 no votes. People just sort of pile on with unpopular legislation. He kind of charts his own path. He was head of the Black Caucus for a while, and now he's no longer in that position. I think Greg's right. This is still something of a mystery right now, and it's going to be something people are going to be watching for a little while.
There is one little difference there. The difference is that in those other cases, the Speaker didn't put his prestige on the line. The Speaker did put his prestige on the line this time, not only on this bill, but some other overrides that lost this week because Mr. Duncan was not there to vote for social service spending and things of that nature. That kind of puts it in a different category, which only deepens the mystery.
You're right. And the Speaker, in a news conference after the session on Wednesday, he would not go anywhere near describing what he might do, if anything, to retaliate against Mr. Duncan. But certainly in the past, legislators have lost committee chairmanships and things like that for lesser infractions.
That's what interested me is that Speaker Madigan, though, he knows what the Democrats' votes will be and whether they have the votes when it actually take place. I'm not talking about the night before, the day of, where they're saying, oh, yeah, we have enough votes. When those bills are getting ready to go on the floor, he knows how he's doing and how he fares, and he put a lot of these bills out there anyway. Why do you think he did that?
Well, it occurs to me one reason he did it was to get roll calls where there's a popular program or a program that makes a lot of fiscal sense. For example, providing subsidized daycare for single moms who want to go out and work and have nowhere to put their kids. And Rauner administration changed the rules to basically eliminate 90% of the people going forward who would have been eligible before the rules were changed. And so legislation was offered to reverse that. And that's a bill on which the Republicans voted no. So there's a roll call you can use against them in campaign. So that might be one reason, just to string people out on, even though knowing that the votes aren't there, getting a roll call that can be used against people in their home district and say, you supported the governor instead of your constituents. Kind of the flip of what the Rauner administration says, you support Michael Madigan rather than your constituents.
Yeah, and we did see one Republican at least cross over when this override motion came up in the Senate a few weeks ago to vote with the Democrats in favor of the AFSCME legislation. That did not happen this time in the House. There were a few Republicans, particularly those from the Springfield area, who voted present. They didn't want to, you know, have that recorded vote of saying no. But in effect, if you're a union member, I think you would be justifiably upset at, you know, your state representative that you know, there's a lot of union members and government workers in Springfield and the surrounding areas. And, you hear some chatter that people are pretty upset with them over this this vote. But, you know, you got to hand it to the governor. The Republicans did stick together. It would have only taken, one or two, depending on whether you believe Representative Drury, a Democrat who ended up voting no, the only Democrat who ended up voting no, wouldn't have stuck with the rest of his caucus if Representative Duncan was there. But it wouldn't have taken many Republicans to tip the balance, and they did stick together.
Well, yeah, and had all 71 Democrats been there and voting for it, the final roll call would have been closer to 80, I would think, because Republicans in districts with a strong union presence would have jumped on board. And I would hope that the Rauner administration would be sophisticated enough to realize, okay, we've lost the vote anyway. Why not let our guys help themselves out in their districts?
Well, I think, Charlie, you're getting in a really important point here. I mean, the first glance takeaway from all this is that the governor's people, the Republicans, held together and the Democrats didn't, so the governor still is in the game. And the danger here from Bruce Rauner's perspective is he's going to overinterpret this as a big win and I can get whatever I want. That's not the case. This was a near-death experience for him. If they'd all been there, a good chunk of his influence would have gone bye-bye. He still needs to move toward the middle because, as all of you correctly point out, the union influence does not stop with the Democratic Party. It crosses the aisle.
Well, here's another thought that's probably off the wall. Here's an opportunity for the governor to jump up and down and wave his arms and say, I won, and then become magnanimous and say, okay, I've won. Now I'm willing to negotiate on this other stuff.
And that would be smart.
Was that going through Michael Madigan's mind when he realized Duncan's not here? I have a couple other people who are shaky. I'm going to run it anyway, give the governor his victory so that maybe he'll come down to earth and start to realistically deal with what the real issues are facing the state.
One thing, and I'd be interested in your perspective on this, Greg Hines, is I've often said at the state capitol, you usually have five political parties. You have the governor's political party, then you have a House Speaker's political party, the Senate President's, and each minority leader. Right now, it looks like we still have the Democrats with their own political parties in each chamber, but it looks like there is unity that Bruce Rauner has and loyalty that he has from the Republican membership, even the very small one on the state Senate side.
That is the case, but the very fact that there were, seven folks who didn't vote on this on the Republican side, who didn't vote against it, tells you something. This is, all politics is local. Every one of these folks has to go back to their district, and they have to deal with the powers that are there. And while the governor and the governor's money are going to be helpful, they aren't necessarily all controlling. This is still very much a chess match undecided. For the speaker went a little too far here. He pushed out on a limb and it got cut off. That limb is still there for this governor if he goes too far. I think Charlie's suggestion that maybe he ought to now declare victory and move to the middle is something I'd really think about if I run his team.
Well, I think also one of the influences that we've never had in the past is here's a governor who basically has unlimited resources behind him of his own and of his friends, and he's indicated that he's going to be willing to use them to help you if you're on his side or to go against you and maybe sponsor somebody against you in the primary if you cross him. That's never existed before with our prior Republican governors. Of course, none of them had the wealth at their disposal that the current chief executive does.
Yeah, there was some commentator, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting who it was, so I'm plagiarizing somebody right now, but who said, you know, the governor succeeded in getting a bunch of House Republicans to vote his conscience and not their own consciences. And that's that is a good, you know, it might seem good for him in the short run, but that could be problematic in the long run.
And going to the actual legislation, there was a couple of things that maybe that legislation didn't hold water as well as some would hope. And I think, Greg, you may have written on this some, but this was a piece of legislation that was clearly political in its design. It wasn't to permanently take the rights away from the governor. It was one of those with a four-year range, so only likely to impact the current governor. And so your views there, Greg.
Well, you're right. The backdrop here is that is that Democrats and organized labor say that this governor is being unfair in the current negotiations, primarily with AFSCME, that he's trying to provoke a strike by asking that the unions agree to health care cut costs that amount to about a 5% across the board pay cut. Well, that's not an easy sell anytime. If I were in a union, or heck, if I was in my job here, if the boss came in and said you had to take a 5% pay cut, it'd get me all upset. So they say, well, we don't want to force unions to strike, so we'll give it to an outside arbitrator. But the Republicans come back and say, hey, all these health care cuts we have to implement. The Democrats, when they passed the budget, they didn't provide enough money to pay for health insurance. So we have to. We're just following Mike Manikin's budget. Beyond that, they say everybody knows that arbitrators are tilted in favor of unions. They tend to split the baby and whatever. And we've got financial emergencies in Illinois. We've got to get control of our costs and so forth. There's good arguments on both sides of that debate, but it's certainly complicated and it explains the politics, because it's absolutely about politics. It's about leverage. Who's going to have the most leverage in contract negotiations, the governor or the unions?
Well, and it's interesting to me that this is something that has arisen because of who the governor is. We've had a quarter century of collective bargaining with the public employee unions and Republican governors in the past, with Thompson, with Edgar, with Ryan. They never felt as threatened as they do by the current executive, who said, he's made it pretty clear that he thinks public employee unions are a bad deal for taxpayers. And so if you're a union member, I think you have a right to be paranoid and to say, okay, as long as this guy is governor, we want the opportunity to have an outside arbitrator choose whether our final offer or the governor's final offer is better. And the research suggests that in arbitration, both sides tend to move towards the middle and tend to close the gaps out of fear that if their final offer it seems too extreme to the arbitrator, he'll take the other side.
I don't disagree with any of that, but the Rauner counter to that is that this 25 years of bipartisan labor peace, what has this bought us? It's bought us a state that's financially bankrupt, the worst-rated state of
Yeah, but that's nonsense. If you look at history, Greg, that's not the reason why we're bankrupt. It's not because we have millionaire state employees, sweetheart contracts. The reason we're bankrupt is for so many years we've spent money on programs, particularly human service programs, that exceed our tax capacity, not our capacity, but the amount of money that's coming in. And for a long time, we did it by not making pension payments. Now we're on a plan where we're actually paying off that pension debt, and that's what soaks up huge amounts of money. So it's not the fact that we've had all these sweetheart union contracts, in my opinion, that has put us where we are. It's basically that our revenue structure doesn't match up to what our spending desires are.
I think the truth is a little more nuanced than that. I don't buy necessarily all the conservative arguments that state workers are ridiculously paid and whatever. On the other hand, this argument that we have to continue to give everybody who's retired a 3% increase every year, even though inflation is only 1 or 2%, each of these folks is getting effectively a pay increase at the public's expense every year. An annuity increase every year at the public expense. That's where the real money is. It's real costly, and it can't be saved over there.
But that's also something that at the moment is off the table, because the Supreme Court has said you can't change that, because that's what Madigan and Quinn and John Cullerton attempted to do. So maybe what they need to do is go back to the suggestion that Cullerton had, where you offer – well, you can't do it to retirees, but you could do it to current employees. You could say, give up your COLA in return for something else when you retire.
I suspect the court wouldn't buy that, but let me provide another option here, which is where we get into all this week's stuff. If you can't save, if you got to put the money into pensions, well, maybe you save it on payroll and health insurance. It's all green. It's all fungible. If you have to spend it over here, you take it from there.
I wonder if, this sort of the union and the governor waiting to see how this would play out has kind of stalled contract negotiations a little bit. Both sides have stuck close to their earlier, bargaining positions. And it's, you know, it's Greg mentioned the health insurance. You know, the governor wants union members and state workers to pay more for health insurance. And that was actually included in the Democratic budget that they sent to the governor, which the governor mostly vetoed as well. But, you know, there are other things in there that the governor's asking for, too. He wanted to not have to collect fees for the unions automatically out of state paychecks. I mean, you do get the sense, both from his rhetoric and from these bargaining positions, that there is a sort of a deep-seated skepticism of unions here. But I've just wondered if there is, you know, if they've been both sort of holding back a little bit about, you know, getting more serious with the negotiations while waiting to see how this arbitration legislation would fare.
One thing, Greg, I've noticed, they affected about maybe 4,500 state employees, but Rauner has been out touting his the deals or preliminary deals with the various Teamsters groups. Did the Teamsters that you know of give much away in their bargaining, and would AFSCME get the treatment that the Teamsters received with their contract negotiation?
They do seem to have agreed to something that includes much of what the governor's trying to get from AFSCME. But you know, different unions have different priorities. There's different things they need. You know, for Teamsters, just having a job maybe the top priority because that's much more seasonal than office workers, I think. But yeah, he struck a deal, and they talked about it a lot. But I think even the Teamsters, at least some of the Teamsters, expressed opposition to the proposal that was on the table.
I think what's one of the key things, a four-year wage freeze?
Yeah, four-year wage freeze, a 40-hour work week, which is something the governor has said that, you know, he wants from AFSCME as well. I mean, this is a small group, and I think that, you know, as you've been getting at, Greg, that, you know, the Teamsters are not in the same position as AFSCME. I think AFSCME sees themselves as at the vanguard of an existential fight for government employee unions in this state with this governor. And the Teamsters, you know, I can't remember who said it. Was it you, Greg? That, you know, they may just be happy to have a job at this point.
Well, I mean, there's no question that this governor has it in for organized labor. And he's gone too far. It hurts him politically. It hurts him in his ability to get stuff through the Capitol. I agree with him that there's real need for some financial changes here. But it's time for him, I think, this budget standoff can't continue forever. It's good for nobody. I mean, sooner or later, we're spending more, and I think now every day, than we're taking in. Sooner or later, that's going to really clock us all, because we, the people, are going to have to come up for it. So, you know, I understand the governor doesn't like labor. Some of the stuff he wants is good, some of it's not. But for heaven's sake, take a look at it, reevaluate. Don't take the whole ship down with you for your principles, Governor.
I want to move on to another subject while we have you, Greg, and that is for our listeners around the state, mostly in downstate Illinois, that will hear this show. There is tax talk from the mayor of Chicago. Can you outline and give us an overview of that?
We have the same problem in the city of Chicago that the state has, which is we've not been putting enough money into the pension plans, and the bill is now coming due. A few years ago, the speaker passed legislation to require that starting next year, the city of Chicago dramatically ramp up the amount of money it puts into its police and fire department pension plans, which are now only have like 30% or 40% of what they need on hand, and their solvency is at risk. Well, the bill for that is $528 million more than we're paying this year. That's a lot of money. The mayor was able to get a bill through Springfield to stretch that out for a while and lower it down to 300 and change, but the governor hasn't signed it. It's caught up in this overall budget war. So it would appear that the mayor is now going to finally bite the bullet and come up with the money needed to put these things on an actuarial level basis to pay what we're supposed to have been paying but haven't been paying for 25 years. There's a lot of little taxes. They're talking about charging for garbage collection now, and they're going to tax e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes. But the main thing, the most reliable source of income any local unit of government has is the property tax. So the mayor is proposing to increase the city's share of the property tax bill a whopping 60%, give or take, at one fell swoop. That's a lot of money, particularly since Chicago Public Schools, which have the same problem of underfunding pensions, are likely to have to come back and ask us for a big property tax increase, too. Nobody's happy about it, but I'm not sure there's an alternative, given what the Supreme Court has decided, which is you owe the money, pay it.
How about political damage for the mayor? Or is this just, this is the perfect time, the election's far enough away?
I've always assumed that Rahm Emanuel is going to be not going to run again. So at this point, he might as well go for the gold from a fiscal conservative's perspective. He's making the tough decisions that we should have made in this town a long time ago. Pay the bills as they come due. The money's due and owing, so let's not quit trying to fake it and work something out and borrow. Let's do what we're supposed to do. It's a little early to see how this plays out. There's some intriguing signs out of City Hall that the mayor may partially exempt homeowners from this and pass more of the bill onto business groups. That would help him a little politically. But I'm not sure at this point that he's worried about his reelection, because I'm not sure there's going to be a reelection. He's worried about preventing the city from literally going down the tubes financially. I mean, our debt now is at junk levels, and that, you know, when the history books get written, that with Rahm Emanuel's name next to that, he wants to change that.
We've got a couple of minutes left in the show. I want to get some notes from the field in. I'll start with Brian Mackey.
Yeah, there was a moment of bipartisan kumbaya this week in the Illinois House. Both Democrats and Republicans voted 105-5, which is about as overwhelming as you get these days in the General Assembly, to overturn the governor's veto of anti-heroin legislation. Governor accepted most of what was in there, but he did reject part of the legislation, which would have paid for treatment for low-income poor people who are addicted to heroin. The House Republicans and Democrats came together to restore that portion, which is expected to cost anywhere $25 to $60 million a year.
And Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the flash index from the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs has come out again, and it shows that Illinois economy continues its slow but steady growth.
Greg Hines, a note from the field from you.
President Obama, please tell us you're going to come home. It doesn't look like it. Based on this week's stories, there was another big hint that when this president finishes his presidency, he will be living in New York City, which will be the base for his future operations. But his library and the things he's accomplished in the past will be based here.
Although home sales, or the home sales prices, as I saw somewhere the other day, are doing well in his Chicago neighborhood. That's all the time we have for this week's edition of State Week in Review. Thanks to Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.